Our speaker this morning is Elder S. Dilworth Young of the Council of 70.
Members of the faculty and students. Get it put where it's going to be and then leave it there. Originally, I was invited to come here on February 22nd. That wasn't the original invitation, but that's where it finally ended. When my engagement was changed until this morning, I saw no reason why I should change the subject upon which I decided I should like to speak to you. My justification for what I'm about to say and the illustrations I'm about to use, I thought perhaps I'd better epitomize for you before I started, and so I wrote them on a card. Looking back, when we see that heavy burdens are to be borne by men in later life, the men seem to be hardened and conditioned in their youth by many little, then larger, and finally heavy preparation. That will be my thesis. Governor Dinwiddie, the British governor of the colony of Virginia, was worried about the French. He heard rumors that they were going to come down from the Canadian lakes and occupy all of the Ohio Valley. He didn't know how true the rumors were, and so he turned to a messenger to find out. The messenger was a young boy by the name of George Washington. I say boy, he was your age, I suspect, 18. Washington started out at first alone with his horses. When he got away back into the wilderness, he met a frontiersman by the name of Gist. Now, I don't know whether his name is pronounced Gist or Gist. I'll suppose it's Gist. Gist was in every way as able a man as, for example, Daniel Boone, or Davy Crockett, or Kit Carson, in his way and in his time. And he, with a party of others, proceeded to help Washington get to where he was to go. First, they had to go to the Forks of the Ohio. In those days, as it was called, now known as the area around Pittsburgh, where the Monongahela and the, well, I can't remember the name of the other river, come together and make the Ohio River. That was the crucial point. Then going down for several days' journey below that, they finally came to the cabin of Half King, the great sachem, chief of the Indians in the neighborhood, to enlist his support. Finally, they, with Half King and some of the braves, journeyed overland toward Lake Erie to within about 20 miles of Lake Erie across Ohio and came to the French post. The conversations there were not very long, but the gist of them was that the French had no intention of being intimidated by the British. That they intended to occupy the country, and the British could do what they could about it, but that was their intention. Washington realized that he had to get the message back quickly. And so he started out with his horses and with Gist and two or three Indian guides. The snow got deep. It was now December. And after 2 days of travel with the horses, Washington was making such slow progress with them that in his impatience, he proposed to Gist that they leave the horses with the party, and he and Gist traveled by foot the rest of the way. Gist tried to dissuade him because he realized that young Washington had had no experience in long tramps in the woods in wintertime and likely would give out. But Washington was determined, so with one Indian as a guide to assist him to get to the crossing of the Allegheny, that was the other river, they started out. Washington soon learned what it is to travel in deep snow in wintertime when you're not used to it. He was exhausted his first day. They carried small packs on their backs, and he says in his diary that he tied himself into his overcoat. What he meant by that, I don't know, but I can imagine he got it on so it wouldn't come off. As they went along in their travels at the beginning of the second day, they began to notice that the Indian was traveling too far to the northwest. too far to the northeast rather than to the southeast. And they began to suspect him, but neither said anything of his fears to the other. And finally, as it got toward evening, the Indian, being a short distance ahead, suddenly wheeled and fired a shot at them. It missed, and before the Indian could do anything about it, they were upon him. Gist was for killing him immediately and would have done so. But Washington asked him not to and insisted that he be left live. Whereupon they, keeping the Indian ahead of them, tramped through the woods in the general direction which they know they should take, camped for the night, and then Gist whispered to Washington they must get rid of this Indian because he could bring others. And so Gist drummed him out of camp and followed him for 5 or 6 miles to be sure he kept going. And when he came back, he told Washington they would have to move. So even though they'd tramped all day in the deep snow, and Washington was exhausted, as danger faced them, their lives were at stake, he found hidden sources and hidden power, and they tramped on all night. They came finally to the crossing of the Allegheny River. The river, instead of being frozen over as they hoped, was flooded with the storms that had taken place, and snow and rain, and they could not cross. There was a good deal of ice in the stream, too. Washington and Gist spent the day chopping logs and making a raft. And that's the one story, my friends, that's true about a hatchet. The only tool they had with which to cut the poles to make the raft was a small hatchet. And they took turns using it. And by night, by dint of constant and hard and rugged effort, they had enough poles cut and enough vines cut to make a raft, on which they embarked toward evening. As they got out in the middle of the stream, the raft began to pick up speed with the current. The ice jostled against it. It was in danger of being capsized. It was a narrow raft. And Washington thought he could best steer it by getting up at the front end with his pole. So up at the front end he got, and pushing his pole down into the water and feeling a bottom to about 10 feet down, he tried to hold the raft. The strength of the current threw him into the water. The raft spun around, and as it began to drift away, Washington managed to get one hand on one of the poles and dragged himself aboard. Instantly, he was encased in ice as the cold winter air struck his sopping wet garments. I don't know how they did it, but they managed to reach a small island in the middle of the stream. And there they stayed all night without fire. And he records that he was glad to be able to breathe the next morning. They got up to find the river frozen solid, upon which, of course, they crossed safely and were soon at Gist's cabin. Washington made that return journey on foot to Gist's cabin and on into Virginia in 25 days, delivered his message to the governor, and learned that he could stay alive and handle himself and take care of himself in the wilderness. On the trip also, he learned something about Indians that stood him in good stead later on. The governor immediately sent him to save the forks of the Ohio, gave him 4 companies of militia, and he then tried to raise wagons and horses to haul the supplies they would have to have. He had 70 wagons promised. 10 showed up. They had several hundred head of horses promised. None showed up. And the struggles that Washington went through to get that expedition going. Finally, he gave up and put the packs on the men, and with what 2 or 3 wagons he could muster, they started out and made for the forks of the Ohio. His first major military engagement was had with a small French scouting party. He won that engagement, but a few days later, they were surrounded, encompassed in the little fort they had built, were forced to surrender. And Washington was allowed to retire with the honors of war, which means that you can take your men with you without any of them being killed. And retired back, his first major defeat. In that little engagement and in that effort, he learned also something about handling men. And he learned that the word of men when they promise wagons isn't much good, especially if the men who make the promise have no means of paying for them. A final thing that he did in that particular campaign, which lasted considerable time and ended, of course, in the death of Braddock, was as an aide to General Braddock, after the death of Braddock and the army was in full retreat and threatened with an annihilation, there were some reinforcements back a distance of, I think, 1.5 or 2 days' journey. Washington, as the aide, was dispatched to asked for the reinforcements and to bring the aid. He mounted a horse, and he rode until he got there. I think the time in the saddle, as I recall it, was 60 hours. He dismounted from his horse and was not able to talk. He had to rest several hours before he could muster enough strength to deliver the message he had to deliver. I'm sure that I couldn't have ridden 60 hours. The fortitude and the determination of the man to do what he was told and what he was expected to do was exhibited in this particular ride. I now skip to the American Revolution. You all have seen the picture, an imaginary one, of course, in which Washington is depicted as crossing the Delaware, and you would think he was crossing an ocean. There are no shores in sight. The fact in the case are the Delaware is just about as wide as from here to the east wall of this building, a little narrower than that where he crossed. They started at night on Christmas Eve to cross, and by 4 o'clock in the morning, he had his army of 2,400 men and 18 cannon across, 9 miles above Trenton. A misty rain began to fall, which froze the minute it struck the ground, so that within minutes, the road, poor as it was, which they had to traverse going toward Trenton, was a solid sheet of slick ice, as was the surrounding land on both sides of it. To march 2,400 men 9 miles before daylight, starting at 4:30 in the morning, on ice was his task. And they began to go. After they'd gone a distance, as it neared daylight, they suddenly came upon a patrol of their own men, which had been sent out unknown to Washington by General Stephen. These men had run across a Hessian sentry and had been forced to shoot him. The act of shooting, the noise of the gun, the missing of the sentry alone would have alerted the troops in Trenton. So exasperated was Washington that, well, you can imagine how exasperated and angry he was. This is what he said to General Stephen. "You, sir, may have ruined my plans by putting them on their guard." That's all he said. Then he turned to the patrol leader, the man who had done the scouting and been out all night, and he said, "Your men must be fatigued by their hard service. They must proceed with the vanguard and not endure the weights the troops farther back must endure." General Lee, an enigma wrapped up in a mystery, as Churchill says, in the Revolution, wrote a letter to one of the officers under Washington's staff, by the name of Reed. A disparaging and disloyal letter concerning Washington. A letter which reduced him in size and pointed out his defects and made propositions. He sent the letter in an official dispatch to the officer. All mail that came to that officer's table in the official dispatch, if the officer didn't happen to be there, was opened, of course, and read, and the material in it was taken care of by the staff. Washington opened the letter, therefore, it being an official in an official envelope. He read it. Can you imagine his feelings? It would be just about like President Richards writing a letter to myself concerning how poor a man for the presidency of the church President McKay is, and disparaging him, his right-hand man whom he trusted, doing a trick like that. Washington sat down and wrote a letter back to Reed, and this is what he said. "Dear Sir, the enclosed was put into my hands by an express from the White Plains. Having no idea of its being a private letter, much less suspecting the tenancy of the correspondence, I opened it, as I have done all other letters to you from the same place upon the business of your office, as I conceived and found them to be. This, as it is the truth, must be my excuse for seeing the contents of a letter which neither inclination or intention would have prompted me to. I thank you for the trouble and fatigue you have undergone in your journey to Burlington, and sincerely wish that your labors may be crowned with the desired success. Your obedient servant, George Washington." Suppose my young friends that Dr. Wayne hails, I'll use him because he's a friend of mine and won't take any offense, should propose to replace President Wilkinson as president of your university with Harvey Taylor, who is also a good friend and therefore will take no offense either. He circulates among the faculty members whom he thinks he can trust a letter, and also talks favorably to Brother Taylor, disparagingly of President Wilkinson, and gains their private support. He even lets Brother Taylor know that he's doing this, and Brother Taylor rather kind of likes the idea. He doesn't repudiate it. He just thinks he'll sit back and see how things go. And if it comes that he's the president, well and good. And if it doesn't, he's not hurt. He had no part in it. You see the situation, do you? It isn't very pleasant, is it? Well, there was a general by the name of Conway in the revolutionary days who conspired with General Gates on about that basis to supplant Washington. They call it the Conway Cabal, I believe, in the revolutionary history. And the conspiracy went a long way. And Gates was willing to do it, from all we can tell, although he had no particular part in it. Washington found out about it. Knew all about what was going on and did nothing. He didn't call Gates in. What would President Wilkinson have done had he heard that of Dr. Hales? I don't mean to imply that he's not as good or better than President Washington was. But any ordinary man, and he'd have to be an extraordinary man to do nothing, and most of us are not extraordinary, would have done something. Washington let it go. He thought probably that his record and what he was doing would either uphold him or it wouldn't. He did nothing. In the fall of 1777, a man by the name of Duce, who was a former revolutionist, now a traitor, realizing, I suppose, that the Continental Congress is absolutely impotent, unable to do anything, and not wanting to do anything, thought the war was lost. So by a woman by the name of Mrs. Ferguson, he sent a series of letters to Washington, urging him to deal with the British for the sake of the people of the country, to get peace, to rescind the Declaration of Independence. Duce complimented him and said that he alone stood between calamity and failure. And really, the Congress did appear to be disintegrating, and the war appeared to be lost. This was at Valley Forge. I need not paint you the picture of the discouragement of Valley Forge. Washington promptly gathered up the whole correspondence and sent it to Congress, weak as it was. That was a matter which there was traitorism and spying. He turned it over to the Continental Congress with no comment, and gave the Congress his continued and loyal and complete support. During the time he was fighting the revolution, officers held out men's pay and kept it for themselves. They collected fictitious pay for fictitious soldiers, bonuses. The drunkenness in officers and the men was one of the reasons and the greatest causes of why so many battles were lost. No money was provided by the Congress. No food was purchased. No clothing was ordered, and the men literally sat out Valley Forge naked. Graft and corruption was the rule. He accepted these defects, ignored them, as far as public record is concerned, and did his protesting privately only to the Continental Congress. He moved forward anyhow, seeking always through official channels, through the orderly way, to get things improved. And at the end of the war, when they finally won the last battle and peace was declared, his officers and men were mutinous and threatened mutiny because they had no pay. Washington persuaded them to take what they had, their clothing, their guns, their powder horns, and to go home peacefully, to depend upon the justice of the future to take care of them. His farewell to his men was touching. His officers, I should say. He called them together and he started to say goodbye. Then he choked up and he reached for his handkerchief. Can you see this dignified, 6 foot gentleman as he stands there with his eyes filled with tears? Then he gained control and he said, I have grown gray in your service, and now I am growing blind. I cannot come to each of you, but I shall feel obliged if each of you will come to me and take me by the hand. Knox was first. Loyal, devoted Knox. He embraced Knox, and then, forgetting his dignity, embraced each of the others. He once said, I consider the approbation of the representatives of a free and virtuous people the most enviable reward that can be conferred upon a public character. And through it all, my friends, he served without pay, asking only his expenses as a gentleman of his standing while engaged away from home. Douglas Freeman, who probably knows more than any man living or dead about Washington, or who knew more, he's dead now, had this to say, and I'd like to read it to you. I think it's a good conclusion as far as he's concerned. He made early a pattern of life and stuck to it. Patriotism was absolute because it represented a supreme ideal to which he had resolved to be loyal at any price. His moral courage was high because he had neither failed to offer America his honest best, nor had done anything of which to be ashamed. He was just because justice was right, and because lack of it would cost him some of his self-respect. He could not be fair to himself if he were unjust to others. Courtesy and consideration had similar foundations. No honorable measure of self-restraint was too great a price to pay for the satisfaction of living up to his ideal of complete dedication to his trust. But when it came to public approbation, there was one price he would not pay. He would not purchase popularity by impairing his moral capital. I still quote. Good judgment fashioned the rounds of the ladder of Washington's ambition. Still again, his patience, one of his stoutest qualities, was built of will and self-discipline. What he was, he made himself by will, by effort, by discipline, by ambition. He had the needful strength and direction because he walked the straight line. Oscar Handlin, in the December Atlantic, commenced a series of 5 articles showing that we, America, have become great by a miraculous streak of good luck. Something beyond luck. And said he intended to point out 5 apparently divine favorite events which made us strong. He begins with a miracle at Yorktown. And his second is the miracle of the Louisiana Purchase. He speaks of events which fortune or fate or God inspired for our benefit. Let not him or us forget that in the time of our greatest crisis, while we were still suffering with our birth pains, when it was not yet clear that we would even be born, our greatest miracle was not an event at all. It was a man. Washington is a greater miracle than any of Handlin's events. You may read them if you care to. It is the considered opinion of those who have made the greatest effort to understand the Revolution and its sequel that without the concrete morality and stability and the character of Washington, the Constitution would not have been accepted by the people. All virtue which people yearn for and seldom possess seemed to be made manifest in him, in his acts, his thoughts, and his ideals. Here the candor and the honesty, the keeping of agreements, the singleness of purpose, the complete virtue and personal conduct of a man was the greatest single reason for our country's beginning. As we grow to manhood and womanhood, young folks, it is not given to any of us to know if or not we are the sons of destiny, inspired of the Lord to unknowingly lead the next step in the final drama so rapidly reaching its mighty epic climax. If a survey of the past can be any measure of the destiny of a man, then the lesson to be drawn is that one gets ready for the supreme act in his youth. By early manhood, he must have formed his character in his conduct, in his morals, in honor and in integrity, in charity and in forbearance. As surely as he slips anywhere along the line, that slip can well be the Achilles' heel, which at the crucial moment can be his undoing. It would appear that we here assembled, believing as we do that we are a chosen people to bring to pass the Lord's purposes, can do no less than to prepare for our personal destiny by lives of complete candor and honesty, by the complete keeping of our agreements, by complete singleness of purpose and responsibility, by complete virtue and personal conduct. Who can know but that some one of you, with this code in his soul, and having practiced the code in his youth, may someday himself hear repeated an age-old declaration with his name substituted as deity thunders the call. These I will make my leaders. Abraham, thou wast one of them. Thou wast chosen before thou wast born. May the Lord bless us from all, I pray in Christ's name. Amen.